So we are going to be sort of piggybacking, if you want to put it that way, over the passages that Dave read. He read two different promises, two different times when God brought promises to Abraham. And so there's kind of these three parts to the promise that God kept repeating to Abraham. One, that he would make him a great nation, that he would have kids. Essentially, Abraham and Sarah had no kids, but he said, hey, you're going to have kids, and you're going to have a lot of them. Your generations will be as numerous as the stars in the sky. That was one of the times he took Abraham out and said, hey, look up and see the stars in the sky. You're not going to be able to count your descendants. And then he would give them a land to be their own. And then also that through Abraham's descendants, all people will be blessed. And so that was sort of part of the passage that Dave read to us. We're going to be in Hebrews chapter 6. I said in the first service that Hebrews is a great book. It's a great letter, a great part of the Bible. It's also a challenging part of the Bible sometimes to understand. But there's just some really helpful passages in terms of church and in terms of guiding us, in terms of sort of bringing us back to Christ, in terms of exalting Christ and not getting sort of distracted with other things. There's just some really powerful, clear, helpful passages. There's also some really difficult passages. To be honest, passages that I'm just glad I won't be preaching on this morning, because they would stretch most preachers just to know exactly what's going on. And then also there's kind of like this Jewish sort of Old Testament kind of, lots of Old Testament language, because he's writing to a Jewish audience. And so sometimes it's just hard to connect with that, if we're being honest, as we kind of maybe don't get all the sort of symbolism of the Old Testament that James is kind of carrying, or that the author is carrying into Hebrews. And so we don't always get that symbolism. It can be a challenging book to read. But the part that we're going to read, so it's chapter 6 and verse 13. And what's interesting about this section is I think it's really a part that's going to bring us fresh encouragement. It's encouragement for the discouraged, encouragement for those who are doubting, because that's really the context into which he's writing. He's writing either to first generation believers or to those whose parents were the first generation believers, and they're now the kids of those parents who made the decision to turn, as it were, from Judaism and to accept Christ. And so here they're come to a point where they're at a point of decision, maybe a point of temptation. Was the decision worth it? Was it worth it to turn from the old ways, to turn from the old systems? Was it worth it to turn and to accept Christ as Savior? And that's really the battle that's kind of going through their minds as they think it through. Was it worth it? And so the writer is writing to them, and basically he spells out for them why Christ is enough and why Christ is superior to anything that they would have had in sort of the temple and in angels and the sacrifices and these different things. And so that's why the writer is writing them, and he's warning them, hey, be really careful and don't look back and just glamorize it. Don't look back and just start to elevate it, but rather just remember that Christ is enough and that Christ is superior and supreme. But he also writes to encourage them. I think that's what's neat. And this is the section that I'm going to read is really an encouragement to them that they can come to Christ. Like I said, Christ is enough, but it's more that, hey, don't give up hope. Don't give up hope, but be patient and endure and be steadfast. And so that's why he's writing to them. And I think that's why this passage is so helpful for us this morning, because I just know in a congregation of this size, when you even just to think of the stats of as Christians, how we struggle with discouragement and doubt, there's just that reality in which probably in this gathering this morning, we all deal with it. And some of us deal with it in sort of greater measure. And whether it's that sort of, I know not to pick on him when he's gone, but for Pastor Don, he would say whenever he was, you know, a teenager, that sort of like intellectual wrestling through who Christ was and is he enough and his belief in him. And for some of us, that's where we're at. For some of us, it's maybe more of a moral wrestling of just the struggle to be pure. And so then, is it worth it? Is it worth it to always fight for purity? Or for some of us, it's just the sort of the ongoing maybe weightiness of struggles with health, or struggles with kids that maybe are not walking with the Lord, or just struggles in a tough job situation or just struggles in life in general, and it can lead to a discouragement. And so again, that's where I think there's just a value in looking at this passage. So let me read it and then we'll dive in there. So it's Hebrews chapter 6 and verse 13. For when God made a promise to Abraham, since he had no one greater by whom to swear, he swore by himself, saying, surely I will bless you and multiply you. And thus Abraham, having patiently waited, obtained the promise. For people swear by something greater than themselves. And in all their disputes, an oath is final for confirmation. So when God desired to show more convincingly to the heirs of the promise the unchangeable character of his purpose, he guaranteed it with an oath, so that by two unchangeable things in which it is impossible for God to lie, we who have fled for refuge might have strong encouragement to hold fast to the hope set before us. We have this as a sure and steadfast anchor of the soul, a hope that enters into the inner place behind the curtain, where Jesus has gone as a forerunner on our behalf, having become a high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. So what's the first thing we need to grasp? If we're going to understand this passage, the first thing we're going to get our minds wrapped around is God's promise to Abraham. And I think if we were just to read about God's promise here, we might not grasp just the challenge that Abraham had, the struggle that he was going through. Because when you read it here, of course, it just follows kind of straight on where you read the promise was given, Abraham believed, and then God surely fulfilled that promise. But what we need to do is sort of, you go back into Genesis, and even though it's only a couple of chapters, it covers about a 25-year span where God promised Abraham and Sarah that they would have their own offspring, they would have their own kids. But it's a 25-year period between when they get that promise to when that promise is fulfilled. And it's not an easy 25 years. It's a long period of time for one. But even in that, there's just this tension where there's just, as Abraham and Sarah, their wealth increased. God blessed them with animals and gold and silver. But yet the pain of infertility was something that they dealt with. And it was that 25 years where in that period of time, I think there's about five recorded times where God reaffirms his promise, but also it's not time for the promise to be fulfilled. They have to wait. They have to wait. And so again, just when you think about that 25-year span, it must have been a tough, tough period. And you get a little hint of that even in the passage that Dave read where God comes to Abraham and says, hey, I'm your refuge, I'm your shield and your great reward. And Abraham responds with, well, what will you give me? How can you bless me? How can you really bless me? Because I have no kids. And I think it was just Abraham at a point of frustration where he's just able to voice and say, you know, look, Lord, I get your promise to me, but when will it be answered? When will it be answered? And even you get maybe the period where even Abraham and Sarah try to solve the problem themselves and really make more of a mess of the situation when they bring in Sarah's servant. But yet that's that period of waiting. That period of waiting is just something that God seems to use. Developing patience, developing steadfastness is just a quality that seems a priority for God. And I think there's a little bit of a tension because it's not always a priority for us. I think for us, maybe the priority that's more of a priority is comfort and maybe the here and now, both those things kind of coupled together. And it just seems sometimes inefficient that we would wait. And yet if you were to look through scripture, you see just lots of instruction about waiting patiently. You see lots of value placed on steadfastness and how steadfastness will be developed in us. And so we see this reality in which even in the life of Abraham and even in that promise, God was not slow or forgetful in keeping his promise, but God had a purpose and a plan that he was working out in Abraham and Sarah's life. And so too for us, just that reminder that this week, yes, there'll probably be different challenges and different discouragements that we will face, but yet just remember that it's not time wasted, but rather that God is working out his purposes in the development of steadfastness and in the development of making us more like Christ. Of course, that we need to remember just the reality that God is not just sort of giving us our best life now. Yes, definitely he works in our lives now. I'm not disputing that. But that God is working in us to prepare us for eternity, for glory, and to make us more like him, to make us more Christ-like. And so even here and now, that God is developing that Christ-like character. And part of that is developed and is shaped through the waiting. Boy, but that's tough. That's hard sometimes to wait. It's difficult to be patient. And yet the writer to the Hebrews, he wants the people to recognize, the recipients of the letter, hey, yes, there is a process of waiting. Yes, it's not easy, but don't give up hope. God has not forsaken you or forgotten you, but God is still going to unfold and reveal his promises in his good time. So you've got the promise, God's promise to Abraham. Then we need to think a little bit about oaths and promises. Again, I don't think oaths have quite the same role as they had back in the Old Testament. Again, if you think of a context where there was not the availability of paper that we would have today, but if you think essentially of signing a contract, if I was to come to some kind of business agreement with someone today, I assume there'd be lawyers and paperwork and some kind of paper trail so that if that other person ever did the wrong thing or ever broke the contract, I have the paperwork and I can show that, hey, you know what, they promised they would do this or I promised I would do this. And so that would be what we'd come back to, the evidence of the paper trail. But yet in this culture, as I say, it was more of an oral culture, more of a spoken culture. And so again, if I was making a promise, coming to an agreement with somebody, then I would bring in a witness. I would make an oath before that witness. And that witness would essentially bear witness to what the agreement that was made. And so the concept was that that person who was the witness was more honorable than I was, that was more trustworthy than the two partners were, the two parties were. And so that was often why that oath was taken before God, because he was the one who was unchangeable, the one who would bear witness. And you get into that sort of the language of sort of blessing and cursing. In other words, if I make this oath and make this commitment and I follow through on that oath, then there'll be a blessing or there'll be kind of agreement. But then there's often a sort of, but if I don't follow through on this, then I would bring curses or bring woe on myself. And so you get into that same language here, and it's maybe a little confusing, because what the writer is trying to get across is that God made a promise to Abraham. God made a promise and God made an oath to Abraham. You see that there? That's the two things. See verse 18, so that by two unchangeable things, the unchangeable things are God's promise and God's oath, because he gave both of those to Abraham. There was a time when he promised, your offspring will be great. And then there's another time where he promises the same thing, but he sort of emphasizes that he does it by an oath. He makes an oath with Abraham. But who does God use to validate the oath? Who does God need? He needs nobody. And that's what the writer is saying, that God's oath and his promise, they line up with the very character and the heart of God. And he wants the people, what he's really trying to do is pastorally to bring them back and say, hey, you can go back to the old system if you want, but here's what you're turning from. You're turning from the promise that God has given you. And those promises are this reflection of who he is, his very character and his very essence, that he as a good God has come to you and he has given you these promises. And so that's just as you're working your way through the passage, that's kind of the, you know, like there in verse 13, since he had no one greater by whom to swear, he swore by himself, saying, surely I will bless you and multiply you. My mind went to Jesus. Remember when Jesus was stated it pretty simply, let your yes be yes and your no be no? By the time Jesus had came along, sadly, the role of the oath had been twisted. There was all kinds of ways that had been twisted, where if I said something and I hadn't made an oath, then it was almost like I had freedom to lie. And so that was part of what went on. And then also, remember, there was those verses where Jesus addresses the Pharisees directly and he calls them out because they make these oaths based on elements that were in the synagogues. Sort of like, it would be like making an oath by the music stand. So I swear by this music stand, then I have to follow through on it, but I swear by the keyboard and I don't have to follow through on it. Just kind of like this twistedness where they'd taken the essence. And the essence was simply what Jesus said, is that it's not that I'm permitted to lie most of the time, but whenever I make an oath, I have to tell the truth. But Jesus just said, look, as a general rule, your yes has to be yes and your no has to be no. You tell the truth. And he wasn't necessarily saying, don't make an oath, but he was saying, hey, there's just that reality in which they've twisted things so much that they've missed the heart of it, that we just need to be honest. And so you see there, the first thing, and these first two points are more just sort of background to help us just to understand what's going on. So the first thing was the God's promise to Abraham. The second one was just the oath and the promise. So now, as we move on to the sort of the, as we finish things up here, just a little bit of how does this apply to us? How is this an encouragement to us as we deal with discouragement or doubt, even in this week? Where is the encouragement for us this morning? How can we apply this? As I've mentioned already, the first thing that we can see here is that God can be trusted completely. God can be trusted completely. You see there in verse 17, so when God desired to show more convincingly to the heirs of the promise the unchangeable character of his purpose. So in other words, God wanted to show to Abraham, hey, I am trustworthy, Abraham. You can trust my words. And so God wanted to remind Abraham of that. And I think that's why the promises are repeated those five times, or not even repeated. It was why God came to him five different times and made known to him his promises, because God wanted to remind Abraham about who God is. And so again, just a reminder this morning that we need to remember who God is and that we can trust him completely. That might like seem like a big step to say, I can trust God completely. Surely I've got to hold some back. Surely I've got to have some plan B. And yet here, the writer would say to them, look, no, be sure in the promises. Be confident in what God has said to you and trust him completely. Second thing we can learn from this is our hope is never in vain. You see that little line, of course, I've missed it now. Yeah, we who have fled for refuge. So you get that picture. It's a picture of somebody escaping some kind of trouble, likely being attacked, and they come to that safe place. They're running to that place of safety. And so that's really describing, again, just that picture, that aspect of what it is to be saved. And so speaking of God's people, we see his character, and then we're reminded that we run to him for safety. And so our hope is never in vain. That safe place is indeed a safe place. And so it's just that reminder of that, that this week, whatever you face, wherever you find yourself, there's just that safe place that is sort of symbolized in our relationship with God. And so even this week, just that reminder to run to him, to take our confidence again in him. Practically, that might just be as simply as a prayer. Lord, I'm going into this situation. Lord, I'm going to see the doctor this week and I don't know what the outcome will be. Lord, I'm going to school and it's just not an easy environment to be a Christian. Lord, I'm going to work and I don't find much joy in there, and it's just, I don't find I grow in my faith there. Lord, would you just, may there be a safe place for me. May there be just that sense in which you're with me as a safe place as I go into this difficult situation. But it's our hope is never in vain. When we run to him for refuge, he is faithful. And then we see this third picture of the anchor. The anchor, there in verse 19, we have this sure and steadfast anchor of the soul, a hope that enters into the inner place behind the curtain. It's, of course, pretty simple concept in some senses. You got a boat, you got storms. The first service, I was talking about all the wind and the waves and all the stuff above the surface. Then one of the guys from our church that has a sailboat, and sailboat that you live in, he's gone all kinds of crazy trips with it all over South America and different stuff. He's like, oh, Andrew, you forgot about the currents of the water. Oh, yeah, I never even thought about that. The stuff below the surface that I guess can move your anchor as well. He was educating me in all kinds of anchor-type stories. But there's just this picture in which the storm is going on all around here. We see, maybe even see the danger, the reason why we need an anchor in the first place. But there's just that confidence that that anchor will hold us fast. That anchor will hold us from that danger. And so it's really that role of hope is that anchor. And so he's writing to them and he's saying, hey, hold fast the hope, because that hope is like an anchor for the soul. A hope that enters into the inner place. And so he's saying, in the same way as the anchor is what keeps the ship from danger. He's saying, hey, hope has to be that dominant characteristic, that sort of reliable anchor that we trust in. And so you see, he's calling them again, not to lose sight of the promise of God, not to lose sight of the character of God, but rather to throw their anchor into those things and use it to keep them from the dangers that are surrounding them. And so again, we just see that importance of hope, that importance of hope this week. That can be a hard one sometimes. Sometimes discouragement gets real big. Sometimes it gets really encompassing. Sometimes it gets really weighty. And so it's just like, it just feels like poof, throwing your anchors, just no strength at all. It can be difficult. We'll come back to that one in a bit. But it's interesting what that anchor is attached to. You see, it's a hope. So that anchor of the soul is a hope that enters into the inner place behind the curtain. And so we're getting into that Old Testament kind of tabernacle language or temple language where Jesus has gone as a forerunner on our behalf. That anchor is connected, is attached to what Jesus has done for us. He is the source of where that anchor is attached to. It's what he has done for us. And you see it in these two ways. You see it that he is the forerunner on our behalf. It's one little picture there. That's the picture of where if people were going to take a land, think of Old Testament, where they were going in to spy, to invade a land. And so they would send in the spies beforehand, the scouts, and they would say, hey, you know, there's a good path here. There's dangers here. There's a well here. They would spy out and go before to make the path easier for the guys that were behind. And so it's sort of that same kind of concept that the Lord went before us. He was the one who went before us. And so he knows the difficulties that we will face. He knows what it is to be tempted in every way, as I've mentioned before. And so when we think of our relationship with Christ, it's that he is the forerunner on our behalf. He went before us on our behalf. And in the second image, there in the last half of verse 20, having become a high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. And so it's that role of his where he intercedes for us. And so whenever we think of a weak hope, or when we think of just struggling with the discouragements and the doubts that are around about us, even if it's that little bit of hope, even if it's that little bit of, I just got to get back to the promises of God, it's also that reality that those promises and that anchor is in Christ, the one who has gone before us, who knows all about us, who knows our weaknesses, and who's interceding for us. And so it's just that reminder of don't give up hope. Don't give up hope. But rather just put our trust again in him and rely and rest on his promises, for they are secure. And so, Emmanuel Church family, it's just that reality that even in this week, again, I don't know what you guys are going through, but as I say, with my guess is that for some of us, there's just those things that are heavy, those things that are more difficult. And I just trust that this passage will be just an encouragement to just to wait on his promises, to wait on him, and to know of his goodness, and to keep our eyes on him even as we go through these difficult times, because he is faithful. He is faithful. And his promises for you are sure, and they're steadfast, and he is trustworthy. And to put our trust in him, to run to him for refuge is never in vain, but rather we can depend on him